Now we turn to part two of a workshop begun last month by Dr. Fred Craddock on the art of storytelling within the sermon. He is professor of preaching and New Testament at Candler School of Theology at Emory University in Atlanta. We now present part two of Fred Craddock's workshop for pastors, Preaching as Storytelling.
I'm encouraged by seasons like this, and I hope to add encouragement to your life. That's what we're here for. In the classical sense of the word, to encourage, to give heart to each other. And I welcome encouragement wherever I can get it. Some time ago, I was encouraged at the airport by a stranger in Kansas City. A graduate student at University of Utrecht in Holland. In this country, he said, we just met at the airport, in this country doing research to finish a paper on the influence of the talk of the doctors and nurses in the operating room upon the patient who is under anesthesia. And this clinical pathologist or whatever said that he had demonstrated in his paper that if the talk of the doctors and nurses was cheerful and upward, then there was a sense of euphoria and get-wellism in the patient. But if the doctors were morose and melancholy and griping and snippy and the nurses were, then there was a post-operative depression in the patient. Well, this fellow had to catch a plane. I thanked him. He says, "Why, are you a doctor?" And I said, no. I'm a preacher. But I appreciate that, because if it'll work in surgery, it'll work in the sanctuary. So I hope you won't be discouraged if they are asleep. You just keep right on, because you never know, maybe. Maybe on Thursday or Friday, one of them will begin to feel a little Christian, not know why, but... It's working. I stopped last night, but talking about the difficulty of telling stories, there is a suspicion, just a real lack of trust, that the story really can do anything, that it has any power, that the story is just too fragile. We have read and taken seriously that comment some years ago. Someone who said that the preachers think by telling stories they're going to make a difference. Telling stories will change the world about like breaking up concrete by throwing light bulbs against it. Now, you can believe that if you want to. But I've been present when someone threw a light bulb against concrete walls and they cracked and fell. Just a word. Sometimes I think, I don't want to be accusatory, but sometimes I think that our hesitation in using stories, especially powerful and effective stories, is not that we're afraid they do not have power, we're afraid they do. Do you really want to make a difference? Is it frightening when somebody actually takes seriously what's said? And you find yourself at the door of the church afterwards saying, "Well, I was just preaching." There are people who are afraid of the power of it and therefore pull back with hesitation, disguise it. There is in all of us a temptation to be ineffective. There are two kinds of preaching people will not listen to. Poor preaching and good preaching. And some of us are more afraid of the second than the first. I heard a minister tell once of visiting on one of his parishioners. She had been ill for some time, and as was his custom, he not only visited the sick, but he had prayer, unless it were an awkward moment with a lot of strangers and a lot of noise. He said, "I always had prayer." That was not the case on this occasion. I was getting ready to have prayer. And she said, "Pastor, would you pray for me and with me?" He said, "Of course, I will." He stood at the foot of the bed and prayed for her recovery. And when he finished the prayer, she sat up in bed. Then she swung her feet over the side. She put her feet in her scuffs. She reached for a robe, put on the robe, stood up, stretched herself, and began to jump up and down a little bit, and then grabbed him around the neck and said, "Thank you, Pastor, thank you. I'm well." And he went out to the parking lot. Before he turned the key, he had a little prayer. He said, "Don't ever do that to me again." I do believe that there is, and this is just in-house talk, but I do believe there is in many of us just a lack of trust in the power of the word that's spoken. Jesus compared the word to a seed, and a seed carries its own future in its bosom. The farmer does not put it in the ground and then scream over it. He leaves it alone. And just think of all the ways, even when we're preaching on faith, that we reflect in the way we preach our lack of trust in the very thing we're saying. Many of us operate, I include myself very, very much, out of cautions and hesitations and fears and reservations and defensiveness and protection. I was sitting one night, hot summer night, during a revival, sitting by the window at the back of the church. Minister was up front preaching away on his favorite text, "Be not the first by whom the new is tried, because it's better to be safe than sorry. For when you're in doubt, take the old paths, because a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush." And I listened to this sermon, and it was hot, and the window was open, and a man I'd not known before passed by, tread. I said, "What do you want?" He said, "Want to go with me?" I said, "Where are you going?" "I'm going to a place where there is a pearl that's worth all the other pearls in the world." I said, "There's no such place." He said, "There is. In fact, very close by, there is a field with a buried treasure in it, and I'm going for it." You're making that up." "No, it's true. In fact, where I'm going, beggars and peasants are invited to sit at the king's table." "Really? Oh, you're kidding." "That's right. And they give parties for prodigals." You can't kid me. After the service, the minister said, "What was that disturbance?" I said, somebody full of notions inviting me to get out here and get lost in some strange thing. Who was it? I don't know. Was he by himself?" "Well, there were 12 guys with him." And I speak to myself because I am a hesitant and cautious person. And it's easier for me to encourage other people to be venturesome and risking. It's easier to say it and to preach it than to do it and be it. Now, it might help us to overcome the hesitation if we think about what goes on in storytelling, in the sanctuary, in telling a story. First of all, the storyteller recognizes in telling a story that you're not speaking to people so much as you're speaking for them. Let's remember that in preaching. That in preaching, we don't just speak to those people, we speak for those people. We don't tell them what they want to hear. We've all been warned about that. But why not sometime just now and then tell them what they want to say? See, the unused treasure of preaching is the experience, the faith, the commitment, and love of those people, all of whom have a story to tell, but they can't articulate it. They don't have an opportunity, and when they do, they fumble around, they say, "I can't talk." But you can speak for them. You can say something that they will say, "Yes, yes, yes, I've had that very same experience. That happened to me. You've been reading my mail. Well, when I was about 14. And you know what you're doing? You are evoking all the stories. And the mark of a good story is when it's over, people begin to say, "You know, when you were talking, I was thinking of once when I was at home on the farm." Ah, Now you're stirring the stories, and the stories are coming out, and you're invoking the stories. You're not using the old banking system of talking, of just tamping more in and tamping more in, but you're calling more out. Good storytelling speaks for the congregation and evokes their own stories, and there is nothing more refreshing and more Christian than in the context of prayer and music and song and worship and fellowship in the house of God to have somebody stir up from the deep cellar of my own life the most important experience I can recall. I haven't thought of that in years, but you know, it was at my daughter's wedding. Look what you've done. And then when someone at the door says to you, I really appreciate what you said this morning about so-and-so, and you never said anything about it. That's good preaching. Because preaching then is an act of the people, it's an act of the church in the participation of it. That is, only if your stories are realistic. Now, if they're all shaped into homiletical distortions and contortions, then nobody can identify and no stories are evoked because they're so unrealistic. The number one tragedy of storytelling in churches is stories are bent out of life shape to fit some homiletical enterprise. Let the story stand up on its own, be realistic as life itself, have the smell and sound and taste of life, and that will evoke. But if it's one that only preachers tell, it doesn't, nothing twitches, nothing quivers, nothing is stirred, nobody identified. Because you see, that's what's happening. That's really what's happening. Is because when you tell a story, everybody's relaxed. It's not confrontation time. It's not challenge time. It's relaxing. Once upon a time, everybody relaxed. I remember when I was about 10 years old, I recall waiting for the everybody's relaxed. We used to have this fellow down home. Had a strange speech pattern, and everybody's relaxed. See, you're not saying, I challenge you, I address you. It's not Bultmann's word of address. It's Dodd's narrative. And you're relaxed. And in that relaxation, you're drawn into the story, and identification begins to take place. And if it's a good story, you start identifying with the experience or one of the characters, and that's the power, the great single power in storytelling or in all preaching, is the power of identification. You go to the theater, you even sit in front of television. What makes something very gripping? What makes it very gripping when you're at a theater? And you just say, I want to go back and see it. It just held me. And you go somewhere with friends at a restaurant after the theater, and you can't even talk. You just stare at the cup and... Whew, what happened? You identified with that drama or with one of the characters. Nobody during the play came out and said, now I want to challenge you today. I have six things I want to say about this tonight. It was identification. Now, that's what happens in storytelling. That power takes over. And in that identification, things long buried, known, but not nourished, not dwelt on, not feeding the life, not doing its work, begins to do its work. And things that have long been in the head, known, began to move toward the heart. And that's when life is changed. We know a lot much more than we are. But in the process of storytelling, what we know gradually moves toward the heart and we become what we know. It's been true in my experience. It's still true in my experience. I haven't had, maybe it's my own fault, my own stubbornness, but my life has moved that way rather slowly. And it's a long trip from the head to the heart, from knowing something to knowing something. A sermon is full of information. The what? The content is there. The substance is there. There is information, to be sure. There's something redemptive about information. But preaching is not just transferring information. It's creating the experience of that information. And you have to decide, as the speaker, what is the nature of the experience to be created. For instance, if you are preaching on freedom,
Now, what's going to be the flavor, the size, the sound, the shape of that experience?
You don't just say, I'm preaching Sunday on freedom.
What's it going to sound like? What's it going to look like? What's it going to smell like? What's it going to taste like? There's freedom, and then there's freedom. It might be a loud sermon.
You know, you can preach on freedom, and bombs burst in air, 4th of July parade, firecrackers, drum, 76 trombones, John Philip Sousa down Main Street, freedom!
You can also preach freedom, and it's as quiet as the humming of 6 female voices outside a county jail, we shall overcome. It's as quiet as a whisper in a cabin door, Mr. Lincoln says, we're free.
Now, don't just say you're preaching on freedom. What's the experience you're going to do? What are you going to create?
See, the way you put the words together, create it. For instance, just putting words together, the experience begins. Once upon a time, what's the experience? Fairy tale. There was a certain man, parable. Dearly beloved, we're gathered here today. You know. Whereas the plaintiff or the party of the first part doth hereinafter refer to, you know, we're in court. The way we put it together creates the experience. Now, I hear some potentially powerful passages used in sermons, and it's handled as though it were information. And there was this beggar sitting at the gate. Now, wait a minute. Give me a chance to experience beggar at the gate. See the rags, smell the odor. Hear the coin in the tin cup. See the hollow eyes. Let me get there. Because what Peter and John do is against the backdrop of this terrible need.
We don't have any money, he said. And then comes this.
But let me get there first. You see, don't rush to the destination. Take the trip.
Flood. Preaching on the flood and the rainbow in the sky.
And instead of just saying flood, let's all get to the flood. Now, what's a flood?
It's not just a boat floating out there with a giraffe head sticking out one way.
What's a flood? Have you ever been to a flood? Have you smelled a flood? The silt, the mud, the scraping out the house, you can't get the order. The looter's coming. The National Guard is out.
Whatever happened to this, we'll have to move. The walls falling in, washing all the furniture. You get there and let everybody smell and see and experience a flood. Then when you say rainbow, whoosh, that's good news. Flood and rainbow is not just information. We're dealing with the promise of God.
So storytelling, therefore, is the creation of the experience of the substance of the sermon. Creation of the experience of the content of the sermon. Now, where do we begin?
Well, we begin by listening. We begin by observing.
To listen and to observe. Now, this has to be very careful and very intentional. To be observant, to be open to the sights and sounds of the world around us.
I said to a group of students some time ago, in the spring, that it's my impression that God operates almost completely by whispering, and therefore you have to lean forward to hear it. And a student came up afterward and said, well, but don't you think God sometimes shouts? Whether you're paying any attention or not, you really get it. And I said, well, I suppose it does. I don't want to limit God. And then I remembered an occasion which he had shouted. I was on a plane going to Denver. I was seated, as was my custom, in the no-smoking section. I was on the aisle because the air circulates better out on the aisle. Gets stuffy over next to the window. A man right across the aisle from me, in the no-smoking section, pulled out one of those little long black cigars made out of gunny sack and gunpowder and stuff. You don't smoke cigars anywhere on the plane. Here he is in the no-smoking section. And then the cloud comes up, you know. And so I stopped the flight attendant, in this case a young woman. I said, isn't this no-smoking? She said, yes, it is. I said, well, she said, sir, this is no-smoking. Didn't pay any attention. She said, sir, there's no smoking at the back. I mean, there's smoking in the back. This is no-smoking. He just went right on.
She said, what do I do? I said,
It's terrible up here. She came back by and she said, "Sir, would you please go back to the smoking section?" Didn't say anything. Boy, I'm sitting there boiling. What am I going to do? She came by in a few minutes with the Sprite and the 7-Up and the Coke and the tray, you know, and the peanuts and all like that. We were getting over the mountains. As we got over the mountains, we hit some rough air, and she tilted, and that stuff went over on him. All those glasses over on him, and then she fell back in my lap. Now, don't tell me there's no God. But ordinarily to hear and to see the ways of God in the world, one does have to listen and observe carefully. And the place I would begin is in the listening and observing carefully in the Scripture. Now, I recommend to the students, I say to you, although I know you're not seminarians, let me say, that I recommend to those who are in the rehearsal stage of preaching that the first step, always in the exegesis of the text, the interpretation of the text, is to read the text. Now, I say that because I know it's possible to get up a sermon and never having read the text carefully. It's possible to get up a sermon and just think, well, I remember it real well. Read the text. Read it out loud. Read it several times before you pull out the commentaries and concordances and lexicon. Before you do that, if you bring out all those books, it makes you silent and quiet. Well, what do I know in front of all these fellows? You know, and pretty soon they take over and it's their sermon. Just you and the text. Open up to the text. It's amazing what you discover just reading it. I have a sermon on file. Terrible. I'll not use it anymore. My text, Luke 15, the 99, the going in search of the one sheep that was lost. And in that sermon, I say, and the whole sermon presupposes, that the 99 in Luke 15 were safely in the fold, and he went out looking for the one that was lost. I read the text years later. It doesn't say that at all. Where did I get the idea they were safely in the fold? Well, my recollection of an old hymn we sang in Sunday school opening, the 99 safely lay, sheltered in the fold. What Luke says is, he left the 99 in the wilderness and went looking for the one. Any good businessman will leave 99 in the fold and look for one. But only the risky, careless love of God will leave 99 in the wilderness and look for one. That's high-risk love. That's a different sermon. My old sermon is dead. I used to preach the sermon on the prodigal son. And in order to make the grace of God really be exhibited in my sermon, I would talk about his welcoming this younger boy, and then I would pause between the points of my sermon to kick the older brother. And I just really buffeted him around, knocked him off the back porch, and I just kept on talking about God's love for the younger one. Finally, one day, in desperation, I read the text. And both sons are treated the same. The father goes out to both. The father affirms his love to both. The father affirms his generosity to both. But I had an either-or mind trying to preach a both-and sermon. And I missed the text. It's important just to read the text. Open up the pores of the skin. Get a piece of scratch paper and every conceivable thing that comes to mind. Related, unrelated, relevant, irrelevant. Every old memory, every question, every notion that's triggered, jot it down. It's what Paul Ricoeur calls the first naivete, the first exposure to the text in total naivete. How will the people hear this? I want to identify with my listeners. How will they hear this? So I don't start off with Kazeman's essay on this text. I start off with the text. And just think of all the possible things that come to mind, emotion, heart, feeling, and remembering this, remembering that. Just jot it all down. Now, a lot of that will be thrown away. Because when I get into the exegesis, and I don't just stop there and think, hey, I got a sermon. There's no shortcut to Nazareth. You've got to take the long route every time. But in my exegesis, I go to where some of that early stuff will still stand. But some of it will be thrown away. And sometimes, oh, it's tough. One of those early recollections of something I'll tell in this sermon, I have to throw away. And I have to throw it away. Because a good story, a good piece of material, is a poor servant. It's a great master. It'll take over your sermon. Have you ever attended something and heard someone speak, and they told a real interesting story, and then you used it the next Sunday, even though it didn't fit? It just takes over. Just takes over. Now, some of the stuff, under the pressure and honesty of careful exegesis of the text, will have to be tossed out, because I still believe, not in the autonomy of the text, but in the intentionality of the text. What did the writer intend to say? And I may have to by that study. But the way to begin is to begin with the story. How stories are told. How do the writers tell their stories? Luke is a marvelous storyteller. I mentioned Luke 15, that story of the prodigal son. I've preached on that and preached on that. The way that story is told, so absolutely moving that there's hardly a week goes by but what one identifies with that. Luke's story. When we were in Oklahoma, up the street from us, the family, the parents had divorced. There were some girls in the family, beautiful girls. One of them, about 14, matured very, very early and was into all kinds of difficulty. There was not much home life, and she was truant at school. She was up before the juvenile judge. She was suspected of marijuana and other trafficking drugs, and she was just everywhere. She's hanging on the tail end of every Honda that roared through town. She was just always in trouble. Finally, the judge sent her to a detention home for girls in the southern part of the state. She was pregnant when she went. At the age of 15, she had the child while she was there. We heard about it back home on the street. We also heard she was coming home. The afternoon that she was to come home, all of us in the neighborhood had to mow our yard. And I was mowing my yard and watching up there. I was interested if she really were coming home, because she'd only been gone, 6 months or so. And would she have that baby? So I was mowing the yard, and she didn't come. No car pulled in. She didn't come. And I was down to about a blade at a time. Finally, a car pulled in, and she got out, and she had that baby. Born in prison, out of wedlock. And there she had that baby. So folk in the house came out and grabbed her and kissed her and grabbed the baby, took turns holding that baby. And another car pulled in, and another car pulled in, and they were grabbing her and holding the baby, and some were going in the house, and they started parking in the street. You couldn't get a Christian car down the street. Just parked everywhere. Well, finally, I got self-conscious and went in the house, because it suddenly struck me, suppose one of them in that family sees me down here and says, "Hey, Fred, she's home, and I'd like for you and Nettie to come up. We're giving a party for her, and she has the baby with her." Would I go? And they killed the calf and hired the musicians. And there was music and dancing and a party. Because a boy came home after wasting substance and riotous living with harlots and living with pigs and denying his faith and his moral upbringing. And they gave a party. The party. Now, if you'd lived next door to that old man and he yelled across the hedge and said, "Hey, you know that worthless kid of mine left a couple of years ago? He came in last night. Like for you to come. We're having a party." Would you go? Would you go? It's easier to preach on the prodigal son than to go to that party.
Preaching as Storytelling. On the next edition of Preaching Today, Fred Craddock will conclude this workshop on the principles of effective storytelling. Be listening next month as Dr. Craddock again joins Preaching Today.